This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Shiite uprising against Saddam Hussein is continuing in southern Iraq, although the Republican Guard is reported to be crushing the opposition in some cities. Kurds in the north are also rebelling against Saddam. For some background and analysis, we called Charles Tripp, who has written about Saddam's inner circle and also about the Iran-Iraq War. He teaches at London University School of Oriental and African Studies. Recently, President Bush called on the Iraqi people to overthrow Saddam. I asked Tripp if he thought these rebellions were what the president had in mind.
Well, I begin to wonder. I think that the allies and the powers outside Iraq generally have hoped that somebody would overthrow Saddam Hussein and preferably as well the whole regime that Saddam Hussein has constructed for himself in Iraq. How that was going to come about, I think they were always a bit puzzled, and I think that that's been one of the problems since the beginning of the crisis, that there was a hope that either a fear of an uprising in Iraq or an overthrow would cause Saddam Hussein to moderate his policies, or it would actually happen and the government would change. But it seems that in all sides there's been a certain powerlessness. So whether there was a vision of a mass popular uprising or whether there was a vision of a quiet palace coup d'etat and the assassination of Saddam Hussein, it's difficult to tell. But certainly one could say that the present uprising in both the south and the north of Iraq corresponds to what people might wish, but of course I'm doubtful whether it will actually turn into the overthrow of Saddam Hussein.
Why don't you think it will?
Well, I think that one of the problems is demonstrated by the nature of the revolt. The revolt's very understandable in the sense that both in the southern cities, which are largely Shi'i, the people have been much affected by the demoralization of the war, by memories of oppression, and by the belief that with the chaos of the defeat, the surveillance and the intelligence services have been disintegrated, and so their fear has been lifted momentarily. And this has allowed them to go out on the streets to demonstrate, to seize weapons, and to try and do something about it. But their problem is that they are now sitting ducks for the return of Saddam Hussein, as it were. That is, for the return of the Republican Guard in force into these cities.
Is this the first time that the Guard's been called on to contain uprisings within the country?
Oh, no, far from it. I think that during the Iran-Iraq War, units of the Republican Guard, because they are the most politically trusted, were used to carry out some of the most repugnant operations in Kurdistan against the Kurdish civilian areas and the guerrillas that thrived in them. And after the ending of the Iran-Iraq War, again, the Republican Guard units were used in the marshes of southern Iraq to chase and hunt down and usually kill large numbers of Iraqi army deserters who were lurking in the marshes of southern Iraq and who were picked off after the end of the Iran-Iraq War during 1989.
You know, I can't imagine why the Republican Guards would still be loyal to Saddam Hussein after what he exposed them to. I mean, so many of the Republican Guards were just slaughtered. They had no air cover.
Well, I think that one has to make a distinction. We've been talking about the Republican Guard in general over the last few months in the West, but the Republican Guard, as we see it now, is a product of the disasters of 1986. Up to that time, the Republican Guard was largely just two divisions, and those two divisions were almost exclusively recruited from the home territory of Saddam Hussein around Tikrit and from his own tribesmen of the Abu Nasser. And what happened during 1986 was that they got decimated in battles with the Iranians, and the Republican Guard thereafter was built up enormously into about 10 divisions. So what one has seen is a Republican Guard which is much more like the normal part of the Iraqi army, and a heart or a core of the Republican Guard which remains fiercely loyal to Saddam Hussein. Those units, the people who are fiercely loyal to Saddam Hussein, were not touched in the battle for Kuwait. They were retained around Baghdad.
To protect Saddam.
To protect Saddam, and precisely to be used in the kind of eventuality that they're now being used in, that is to mop up any chaos that might result from military defeat and any mutinous military units that might emerge in Iraq.
What about the rest of the Republican Guard, the part that might not be as loyal to Saddam Hussein? Do you think there's any chance that they would turn against him?
It's always a possibility, but I'm not sure that they would in these circumstances. And here I think one has to go back to the fact that the kind of action which they're now being called upon to take against the southern Shi'i towns and possibly also against the northern Kurdish rebels is very much part of the action for which the Republican Guard has been largely constructed. That is, even if not directly loyal to Saddam Hussein's clan, they are nevertheless seen in many ways to be hostile to the Shi'i, to the Kurds. And in those circumstances, it's unlikely that the Republican Guard will turn against Saddam Hussein, although eventually, once this problem is solved, as it were, in their own way, there might well be a temptation for senior military officers, whether in the Republican Guard or not, to turn against Saddam Hussein.
Two of the populations involved in the current uprisings are the Kurds and the Shiites. They both want to overthrow Saddam Hussein, but do they have conflicting agendas? In other words, if they actually succeeded in overthrowing Saddam, would they want different things?
Well, it's difficult to tell at this stage. I think one of the things that's become noticeable in the last year is the fact that the major political parties of the Kurds, represented by the Iraqi Kurdish Front, and the major political parties of the Shi'i groups, which is called in the umbrella organization the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, these groups have come together, and what they have done is to sign a joint program pledging that they will both support the overthrow of Saddam Hussein and his replacement by a democratic, open political system. And in many ways, this is their last hope, because what they have tried up to now, fighting each other, fighting the regime, proposing their own ideologies, if you like, has been very unsuccessful. So their hope is that at least some form of open democratic system can be established in Iraq, which will allow them to express their views and then possibly pursue interests which are not by any means identical. Unfortunately, there is a large element of the utopian in that, I think.
Do you think that Saddam Hussein was so badly humiliated, not only in losing the war, but in how badly he lost the war, that it would give incentive to his inner circle to overthrow him?
Oh, I think that's a very important part of the mistrust that is probably now beginning to do its corrosive damage in the inner circle of the Iraqi regime, that it was very important for Saddam Hussein in the invasion of Kuwait, in the refusal to withdraw except under his own conditions, to be seen to have retained his face, his honor. And what the group he was appealing to in doing that was largely his inner circle. He didn't really care about the larger Iraqi public, the larger Arab world. What he wanted to try and do was to impress these people with his competence, at least his ability to pull it off, as it were, to gain an apparent advantage for Iraq. Well, clearly, over the last 6 weeks or so, the results of this adventure for Iraq and for the Iraqi elite has been disastrous. And in those circumstances, they will begin to wonder whether Saddam Hussein can, first of all, continue to exert the kinds of control which he has hitherto exerted in Iraq, which has allowed them all to do quite well out of him. And secondly, whether he's capable of ruling them, of looking after their own interests. That is he going to lead them into another adventure, another disaster in the near future? And in order to prevent that from happening, it's a very strong possibility that one of their number will try and get rid of him.
There have been reports that Saddam Hussein's oldest son was killed in southern Iraq. Do you think that these popular uprisings will scare Saddam's inner circle and inspire them to get rid of him to protect themselves?
No, I have a feeling that they might work in the opposite direction, in the sense that the uprisings both in the south and in the north, by the Shi'i in the south and by the Kurds in the north, are so identifiable by the inner circle of Saddam Hussein, who are largely Sunni Arab, as revolts of the Shi'i and of the Kurds. And in many ways, they have no interest in seeing these sorts of revolts succeed. Whatever doubts they may have about Saddam Hussein's leadership, and quite clearly, after the events of the last few months, they are beginning to doubt, obviously, the competence of Saddam Hussein. But in many ways, one can see that the effect of these kinds of revolts on this inner circle would be to tighten the inner circle around Saddam Hussein.
That's interesting. So it might have the opposite effect that it's intended to.
Yes, I think that is quite a strong possibility.
You think that it's likely Saddam Hussein will stay in power a while longer?
Well, I have a feeling that if Saddam Hussein can weather the next 3 weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, then he will be able to stay in power really until he's challenged from within not only the inner circle, but perhaps the slightly larger circle of disgruntled army officers. And that, I think, is unlikely to happen before the next 6 months. So if he can survive the next 2 or 3 weeks, there's a strong possibility, barring assassination, that he can survive at least for the next 6 months or so. I think he has real problems, actually, in trying to survive beyond a year, simply because the economy of Iraq is completely finished. There is no way in which he can marshal the resources which have hitherto kept most of the people on his side. And so a bankrupt regime, an unsuccessful regime, is not one which many people in Iraq want to associate themselves with, and they may well turn against him.
One last question. Saddam Hussein has issued an amnesty for Iraqi deserters. If you were a deserter in the Iraqi army, would you trust him?
No. I think that there have been numerous amnesties before, and the danger has been that people have given themselves in and have simply been shot. But largely, this has depended upon who you are. There was an amnesty for Kurds, and many Kurds were killed when they turned themselves in. There was an amnesty for the largely Shi'i deserters living in the south of the marshes, and again, many of them were killed when they turned themselves in, so they preferred to stay in the marshes, although eventually the Iraqi Republican Guard went and hunted them down in the marshes over the last couple of years. But if you are a deserter who comes from a Sunni Arab background, who represents no sort of threat in terms of alliance with the Kurds or the Shi'i, there's a strong possibility that you would really be able to get away with it. But it's not necessarily something that people are going to risk their lives for.
Charles Tripp, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Charles Tripp is co-author of Iran and Iraq at War and teaches at London University's School of Oriental and African Studies. Coming up, who's waiting in the wings to take over if and when Saddam Hussein falls? This is Fresh Air. The rebelling Kurds and Shiites aren't the only ones who want to overthrow Saddam Hussein. To get an idea of who the Iraqi opposition leaders are, we called Patrick Seal. Seal is a former foreign correspondent for Reuters and The Observer, and is the author of several books on the Middle East, including a recent biography of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. Seal says there's a variety of opposition leaders ready to step in if Saddam is overthrown.
Almost every country surrounding Iraq has a candidate for power in that country. The Iranians have a gentleman called Mohammed Bakr al-Hakim, who comes from a distinguished religious family in Iraq and who has had and enjoyed Iranian protection for some years now, under the cover of something called the Supreme Assembly for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Now, this is an Iranian-backed organization, and for that reason, it doesn't necessarily have a great deal of support inside the country. The Syrians, in turn, have a motley collection of opposition groups under a former Iraqi chief of staff called General Hassan al-Naqib, who fell out of favor in Iraq, was posted as ambassador first to Madrid and then to Stockholm, and then defected, turned up in Damascus, where the Syrians for some years now have been grooming him as a potential successor. Saudi Arabia, in turn, has a number of exiled Iraqi politicians. But it's quite hard, I would say, for any of these neighboring states to impose their own man. Indeed, I would suppose, and this is only a guess, that if Iran, which is one of the countries with direct leverage inside Iraq because of the large Shiite community, if it fails to establish an Islamic government in Baghdad, and it doesn't for the moment look as if it will succeed, then it may well prefer to see Saddam Hussein himself survive, because after all, he's now very weak. They've done business with him. He's made all the concessions which they wanted him to make. He's to some extent dependent on them. So he, in effect, may be their alternative candidate.
All the different opposition candidates who you've mentioned, are these people, are any of these people involved in what we might call pro-democracy groups?
Well, they all proclaim democratic intentions. But I think some of these intentions have to be taken with a pinch of salt. They are all, as I say, supported from outside. The regimes that support them are not noteworthy for their working democracies. And but the fact remains that Iraq is a mosaic of different communities. This is one of the problems right from the beginning of the state, from the foundation of it by the British in the early 1920s. The British, as you know, drew together the Kurds, the Sunni Arabs, the Shiite Arabs, and other groups, Christians and Turkmens. Now, these groups had no tradition of living together except under the Ottoman Empire, and it was quite difficult for the rulers in Baghdad to weld them into a cohesive society. Indeed, one may even say that Saddam Hussein has been more successful than many. But now that his regime has been gravely weakened, these sort of centrifugal tendencies inside Iraq are expected to reemerge. And it'll be quite hard, I think, to keep the country together.
The fighting that's taking place now in the south of Iraq, it's a largely Shiite uprising. Do you think that those Shiites are backed by Iran, or do you think that they're operating independently?
Yes, I would say they were. They certainly have the support of Iran. But Iran will be rather cautious, I would say, in giving direct support. For one thing, direct support from an outside state would weaken the internal opposition rather than strengthen it, because people would say these people are not true patriots. They're actually only agents of a foreign power. And this was the part of the trouble which I think the Iranians had in their support for some dissident groups throughout the Iraq-Iran war. But of course, the Iranians, you may recall at the beginning of the Iraq-Iran war, in the 1980 or thereabouts, the Iraqis expelled to Iran large numbers of Shias who they suspected of disloyalty. Now, the Iranians have mobilized some of these people into a sort of guerrilla army, and they may well be used. Some of them may already be engaged. But I would say that Iran itself will hesitate before showing its hand. It may call for Saddam's overthrow. It may give some discreet support. But it should still want to keep open a line of communication to Saddam himself.
Do you think we're going to see any infighting between the victors of the war, between the Saudis and the Syrians and the English and the Americans, over whose interests are represented in a new government after Saddam Hussein? Whose man gets installed?
Well, the war has created grave dislocations in the region. In the Gulf area, it's created a vacuum of power, because Iraq, whether one likes it or dislikes it, is the major Arab power in the Gulf region. If you destroy Iraq, you immediately hand hegemony in the region to Iran, counterweighted only or counterbalanced by Saudi Arabia. But Saudi Arabia is a very small country in terms of population. It may look big on the map, but it only has a population of perhaps 8 million or so, whereas Iran has a population of 55 million. And Iran sprawls across the whole of the northern shore of the Gulf. So naturally, the destruction of Iraq has robbed the Arabs of a counterweight to Iran. So this, into this vacuum, and this vacuum explains now, I think, this struggle over the question of security in the Gulf. As you know, at least two models have been advanced. One is Iran's model. What Iran is saying is that the security of the countries in the Gulf has to be the responsibility of the countries of the Gulf itself. And, of course, it counts itself as one of the principal countries. The second model could be described as Egypt's model. What Egypt is saying, with some support from the Western powers, is that it should produce or provide the military underpinning for the security of Saudi Arabia and its immediate neighbors, its little Gulf states. And as you may have seen today in Damascus, there was a declaration issued by eight countries, that is to say the six member countries of the Gulf Cooperation Council, plus Egypt, plus Syria, in which they set up a sort of Arab peacekeeping force. So this is, as it were, the Egyptian model, or Egyptian-Syrian model, which appears to be triumphing as opposed to the Iranian model. Now, this is going to cause some strains between Syria and Iran, who are, after all, strategic allies. The Syrians appear to have as it were, chosen the coalition side as opposed to Iran's side. So this I think, is possibly a source for some tension in the future.
What are you most going to be looking out for in the next few weeks now that the war is over?
Well, what everybody is looking out for is American policy. What will James Baker bring to the region this coming week? Now, everybody during the heat of the recent battle was hoping that the United States would apply the same sort of energy to resolving some of the underlying problems of this region, and notably the Palestine problem, as it had shown in the conduct of the war. But one has to say that in the last few days, as the war has receded, skepticism has gained ground. And certainly, if one considers the balance of power on the ground, Israel very, very strong, and the Arabs very weak, and the Palestinians discredited, or at least their leadership discredited, it seems hard to believe that the United States will pursue a settlement of this problem. On the other hand, if it doesn't do so, its moral position in the region will be greatly eroded. There will be many people seeking revenge for the destruction of Iraq and the vast casualties caused there. And indeed, one could well expect a renewed cycle of violence and radicalism. And so it's very much, I would suppose, in America's interest to demonstrate that a wise superpower knows how to strike an even-handed deal in what is a region at present very unbalanced.
Patrick Seale, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
Patrick Seale's latest book is a biography of Syrian President Hafez al-Assad. He spoke to us from his home in London. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.